Okay, so we're ready for the first 18 verses of the first chapter of John. We introduced the gospel, of course, on Sunday. And I want to begin with something that I said here, a question I ask. Why is John so different? Why is John so different from the synoptics? And I said that one of those differences is obvious. And that's at the very beginning of the gospel, what we're looking at tonight. There's nothing else like it in the entire New Testament. Hebrews, the beginning of Hebrews is somewhat analogous, but it's not quite the same. Of course, there's nothing in the gospels like it. But I would again reiterate, there's nothing like it in the rest of the New Testament. So what we're looking at then is a unique text, which makes it especially difficult. So tonight, we're going to do what I think the kids are saying now, a deep dive into the first chapter of John. Isn't that right? I mean, is that sort of? You don't know. So somebody, I've heard it, okay? I'll just say that. I've heard somebody say it, so I said it. So we'll do a deep dive of John chapter 1, the first 18 verses. And part of it is because this prologue sets the tone for the entire gospel. There are things that is said or that are said about Jesus in the prologue that allude to later subjects in the gospel, later chapters. And if we can figure out what John's doing here, it can help us figure out what he's doing elsewhere, even though some of the terminology is different. Some of it's similar, but a lot of it's different. I've already mentioned its uniqueness to the New Testament, but the question that I want us to try to answer tonight, I don't know if we'll finish tonight. We might not, but we'll try, is why does John refer to Jesus as the Logos? That's the Greek word that's translated word, I should say Greek term to avoid confusion. That's the Greek term that's translated word in the text. Logos is the Greek word. In my translation, I'm going to use logos. Why do I do that? Well, hopefully that'll make sense in a few minutes. But one of the reasons I do that is because if we just go with the usual translation of word, we're going to forget or miss connotations that are associated with this. Because let me just get to the point right now. What John does here is put Jesus as the Logos within the framework of Greek philosophy, but also Judaism of the time. And then he proceeds to blow up the categories with what he says, particularly in verse 14, the Logos became flesh. Just completely destroys it. Right, he sets up this foundation, you might say, of orienting Jesus into this Greco-Roman mode of thought, this Jewish mode of thought. And then he says, yes, but Jesus transcends the categories. And that's what he does in verse 14. I'm getting ahead of myself. Okay, so again, the question is, why does John use this term? Of all the things he could have said, he could have referred to Jesus as the Messiah here. Makes sense. He could have referred to Jesus as the Son of God here. Makes sense. He could have referred to Jesus as the Son of Man. Makes sense. He doesn't do any of that. Instead, he uses the Logos. And there's a very good reason or reasons why he does that. Okay, so let's read it first. And then we'll come back and try to answer some of these questions. And just in terms of what is the background, okay? In the beginning was the Logos. And the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and without him, not one thing came into being. I like that translation. This is, other than me using Logos for word, this is the New Revised Standard Version, by the way. So not one thing came into being without him. What has come into being, in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify to the light so that all might believe through him. He himself was not the light, but he came to testify to the light. The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world came into being through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to what was his own, and his own people did not accept him. But to all who received him, who believed in his name, he gave power to become children of God, who were born not of blood or of the will of the flesh or the will of man, but of God. And here it is. And the Logos became flesh and lived or tabernacled among us. And we have seen his glory, the glory as of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. John testified to him and cried out, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me ranks ahead of me because he was before me.' From his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. The law indeed was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. It is God, the only Son, who is close to the Father's heart, who has made him known." All right, so that's the text. We've all read it together. So now let's look at some specifics. First of all, what does logos mean? What does the Greek word mean? Okay, so if you study the Greek New Testament and you're serious about it, the lexicon you use is Bauer, Danker, Art, and Gingrich. BDAG for short, right? So if you look the word up on page 598 and the pages that follow, this is what you're going to find in logos. And by the way, the entry is like four columns. I mean, it's really long. But these are the three main definitions with plenty of examples. Okay, so first, a communication whereby the mind finds expression, word. Okay, that's easy enough. That's like a term. Okay. A term, I mentioned this last time, this podium. The word used to refer to the podium is podium, right? It's just that term. That's the first definition. Easy, right? The second one is computation and reckoning. All right, so in the New Testament, sometimes the language of judgment, you have to give a reckoning for what you've done. That's sometimes the word logos, okay? It's from an accounting term. You can find papyri that have accounting text, and they'll use that terminology, all right? They'll use logos in that way. By the way, very boring, but it's there, and it tells us something about the real world milieu, I guess you could say, of this language. But then we get to the third definition, and this is the important one. An independent, personified expression of God, the Logos. And you see, this is very different than the last two definitions. And that's why, again, I chose to use Logos instead of Word. And by the way, that is not a critique of the translations. It's not like I'm saying these translators, they don't know what they're doing. No, it's not what I'm saying. I mean, you can't really do anything else with it other than translate it Word, or use logos, therefore transliterated. Okay, so again, an independent personified expression of God, the logos. And this is not me, this is from BDAG. Our literature shows traces of a way of thinking that was widespread in contemporary syncretism. Does anybody know what syncretism is? Anybody? Yeah. Yeah, very good, exactly. So in the Greco-Roman world, it could be a combination of different religions, right? You could worship this particular god on this day, and you could worship this other god on this other day. So for example, in the second century, we know there were some Christians who were going to the synagogue on the Sabbath, and then they were going to regular Christian worship services on the Lord's Day, right? So they were mixing it together. That's syncretism. Yeah, very good. Okay? So this is widespread in a lot of different modes of thought or systems of thought, as well as in Jewish wisdom literature. And Philo, we'll talk about him in just a minute. is the distinctive teaching of the fourth gospel that this divine word took on human form in a historical person that is in Jesus. That's where John blows up the categories. Because, again, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but if a Stoic were reading chapter 1, and he or she got to verse 14, where it says, the Logos became flesh, they would think, what are you talking about? That doesn't make any sense. And John would have probably said, yeah, it does, in Jesus. Right? That's probably how he would have answered it. Okay, so we got the lexical definition out of the way. Any questions about this? Again, I said this is going to be, a sustained study, but I don't want this to be too difficult. I don't think so far it is. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe not. So here's some background to the prologue specifically. Greco-Roman philosophy. I don't see how we can read the first 18 verses of John and not think there's some influence of Greco-Roman philosophy. And I'm not just saying this because I really like Greco-Roman philosophy. I really like studying about it. It's there. I don't know any other way to read it. Okay, so we have to deal with it. Specifically, the Stoics developed this idea of the Logos, but they do so in a very different way, and I'll get to that in a minute. The other background, of course, is Judaism. Now, the way that I've separated these, you think, okay, you've got two completely different spheres of thought, but that's not necessarily true, especially when you look at somebody like Philo of Alexandria, who's very well educated, but he's also Jewish. He thinks, for example, that Plato's view of how the world was created sounds like Moses. They agree with each other, right? It's not like he's saying, you know what, I'm going to try to implement some Platonic philosophy into the Bible. No, he thought these are two modes of truth, and so they have to agree, right? So anyway, these aren't necessarily completely distinct either. And maybe that'll make sense too. All right, well, let's talk more about this Greco-Roman philosophical background. Okay, here's the problem. You got the problem of a transcendent being, God, dealing with people, right? So, okay, God is omniscient. He knows everything. Think about our shortcomings, right? If you're well-educated in our society, does that mean you know a little bit about everything? Nope, doesn't mean that. I suppose there still are these people who are polymaths. Anybody know what that is, polymath? Somebody who knows a lot about a lot of different subjects, right? There are people like that, but not in the way it used to be. Okay, why? Because our fields of knowledge are getting so much more specialized, right? I see this in my own experience. You go to a professional conference where people are presenting papers in the same field, right? Let's say early Christian studies, which is what I know something about, right? It's a very small something. There are people presenting papers about stuff I don't know what they're talking about. And I don't think I'm the only person there. I hope not. I don't think I am, right? So what I'm saying is, look how far the gap is between knowing everything and knowing something, maybe quite a bit for a human being. It's not even close to compare God, who knows everything, with our best intellectuals and thinkers of our day. Right? So okay. It's hard for me to conceptualize somebody more intelligent than Aristotle. And Aristotle, by the way, is a polymath. But is he all-knowing? No. There's no comparison, okay? Well, what about the fact that God's all-powerful, right? All-powerful, could do anything. We got some powerful people, both metaphorically and also literally. They're very strong. They're not all-powerful, right? You can't create a universe. They haven't figured that out yet, right? Okay, so again, the gap is enormous. How about perfection? Maybe a good way to think about this is in sports. A few weeks ago, I was watching a motorcycle race, and the guy who won, afterwards the announcer said, that was a perfect race. I mean, he's just flawless. And they asked him afterwards, they said, did you make any mistakes? He said, yeah, I made a couple. And we're talking very minute mistakes, but they were still mistakes, and he admitted it. So even when he just completely dominated, it wasn't perfect. Why? Because perfection is, I mean, to me, perfection is a pipe dream for human beings, right? But then we're talking about God, who is perfect. So the gap is enormous, right? That's the problem. How could a God who's so transcendent have anything to do with us, with me? That's the problem. That's the problem for Greco-Roman philosophers. Okay, now Aristotle went in such a way that he said, all right, God is so transcendent that what he does is he keeps the universe in motion. He didn't create it, because for Aristotle, the universe was eternal. Okay, so he keeps it in motion, the famous unmoved mover, right? And he's perfect. So what does he do? Like, how does he spend his time? Aristotle says he thinks, because that's the highest mode of existence, contemplation. Well, what does he contemplate if he's perfect? Himself. Because that's the only perfect thing. If he thinks about us, who are imperfect beings, well, that minimizes his perfection. I mean, within Aristotle's system, it's airtight, logically. Makes a lot of sense. But you see, other philosophical schools like Plato, like the Stoics, they said, wait a minute. No, God does care about us, right? And when we're talking about God in the Greco-Roman philosophical sense, we're not talking about the gods of Homer, right? Who slept with human beings and who killed people and who were greedy and jealous and those kinds of very negative traits that Plato, by the way, took Homer to task because of it. Anyway, we're not talking about that. We're talking about ideas about God that are much closer to what we believe. And by the way, would anybody in here disagree that God's omniscient, omnipotent, and perfect? I don't think anybody in here would disagree with that. If you do, you can let me know afterwards, and I'll report you to the elders. But I don't think anybody in here would necessarily disagree with that, right? So that's the problem. All right, so the other end of things. So we say, no, he can't be like Aristotle. God does care about us. He's immanent. What is immanence? Acts 17 is a great place to go. Because there, Paul is giving his sermon at the Areopagus. Who's present? Stoics and Epicureans. Stoics in particular were people who knew something about immanence. They believe, no, God isn't so transcendent that he's so far from us. No, he's within all of us. So the Stoics go completely the opposite direction, and they say, God is in everything and everybody. What's this called? Pantheism. Everything's God. You see this in Indian philosophy, by the way. Right? So, namaste, you familiar with that term? If you do yoga, what does that mean? Anybody know what that means? The God within me greets the God within you. Well, what is it? That's pantheism. That's immanence. Okay? So, in Christian theology, this is a problem. How can a transcendent God interact with a temporal, limited and imperfect creature like me and like you? Greek philosophy says the Logos. Well, now, hopefully already that opens up at least one reason why John chose that term. How is the gap bridged between us and God? The Logos. But the Logos isn't the Logos of Greek and Roman philosophy. It's Jesus. Okay, and a good explanation of what this is from Philo. Philo of Alexandria lived about the time of Paul. There's no indication that they knew each other. There's no indication that Philo like heard Jesus preaching or something. He's in Alexandria, Egypt. He does travel to Jerusalem. We know he does at least a couple of times. But there's no indication that he knew Jesus or Paul or anything like that. I think there's some indication that Paul knows of the type of Judaism that Philo practiced. But there's no interaction, at least that I can see clearly. Philo was Jewish, like I've been saying, and he quotes from the Old Testament a bunch. He comments on the Old Testament a bunch. But really the Pentateuch, and the Greek version of the Pentateuch, the Septuagint. Okay, that's what he's doing. But he also believes in Stoic ethics, and he believes in Platonic cosmology. That is, the way the world's created, about like what Plato said. So he mixes all those together. He's difficult to read. Very difficult to read, especially, well, I won't say it, but very difficult to read. Okay. So in one text, Philo says, "And the Father who created the universe has given to his archangelic and most ancient logos a preeminent gift to stand on the confines of both and separated that which had been created from the Creator. And this same logos is continually a suppliant to the immortal God on behalf of the mortal race." You see what Philo's done? He's made that distinction that I made earlier. Immortal God, mortal race, which is exposed to affliction and misery, which is imperfect. That's what he's saying. And is also the ambassador sent by the ruler of all to the subject race. The Logos is the ambassador to human beings. Again, we might put it like this. He's the middleman between the transcendent God and imperfect human beings. That's one reason why John describes Jesus that way, right? Fits perfectly. Well, until you get to verse 14. Okay, the other background then. Well, any questions before we move on? Is this clear? Maybe like mud or something? Okay, good. So, Jewish background. I don't think we need to spend a whole lot of time going through this. So I just tried to summarize it. And I have to be honest, the background here is more obscure than the Greek and Roman philosophical background. The connections just aren't, to me at least, they're just not quite close enough. I think it's there, by the way. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying it's a little bit more difficult to pinpoint, so that's why I'm just going to summarize it. Okay, wisdom personified, like it is in Proverbs 8, becomes a really important concept in these post-biblical texts, like you find in the Apocrypha or the Pseudepigrapha, right? Those are the writings after the Old Testament. They're in Deuterocanonical text, the Apocrypha, they're in the Catholic Bible. Pseudepigrapha is like everything else, basically. But anyway, in those texts, this is important, wisdom. Wisdom and Torah. Torah refers to the law, right? But also the stories. It's not just law. It's the Torah, the tradition with the law. So wisdom and Torah become closely related and even blended together. So, hopefully somebody's thinking, what's the justification for the Jewish background? And I think it's when the explicit comparison is made between Jesus and Moses, around about verses 14 through 16, or maybe 16 through 18, right? That is when you see this clearly enunciated. Okay, so again, it's more obscure, but I think it's there. All right, Proverbs 8. Proverbs 8 gives a different take on creation, right? It mentions something that Genesis 1 or Genesis 2 don't explicitly mention. And that's wisdom. But let's read this, and then let's go to John 1 and look at the differences. Because like I said, some of the stuff John does in chapter 1, 1 through 18 fits perfectly. Some of the other stuff, he goes beyond it. He takes it up a notch, and then verse 14, he blows it up, right? Proverbs 8:22, Yahweh created me, wisdom, at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts of long ago. What's the first thing God created? Wisdom. That's what it says, right? Ages ago I was set up, at the first, before the beginning of the earth, when there were no depths I was brought forth, when there were no springs abounding with water, before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills I was brought forth. Before any of those things, wisdom was there. Was wisdom created? according to Proverbs 8:22 and following, was wisdom created? Yes. Yahweh created me. Right? Unambiguous. So there's a difference, right? Because when we go back to John 1, the Logos isn't created. In the beginning was the Logos. Now, I suppose somebody could say, well, you know, that's pretty close. It doesn't explicitly say he's created, but it's pretty close. But not when you read verse 3. It just doesn't work, right? No, there's no indication he's created. In the beginning was the Logos. What does that sound like? Genesis 1, right? It's a clear allusion to Genesis 1. And so I think, again, we're justified in translating Logos as word, because what's another thing that's going on in John 1? It's a referent to creation in Genesis 1. How did God create? By his word, right? So again, you could look at this as maybe, well, this is maybe a new creation, which is another theme that you find in the Gospel of John, right? In the beginning, yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. Maybe I should have defined that. I think what you said, the very first thing is where it begins, right? In the wisdom literature in the Old Testament, wisdom is knowing there's an order to the universe, right? So it's closely related to creation. So in other words, in the morning, is anybody going to get up and say, yeah, I wonder if the sun's going to come up this morning? I mean, does anybody do that? Well, I don't think so. Maybe you do, but no, there's an order. We expect it, right? And if it didn't happen, well, then we'd know something's wrong, right? So we expect it to the extent we don't even ask it. That's order, right? Wisdom begins there. If there's order in the universe cosmologically, we might say, with the celestial bodies, etc., and there's also moral order, and that's the second thing you mentioned, right? There's also right and wrong. So they're very closely related. So yeah, very good question. And that's how it gets combined with Torah. What does Torah do? Torah tells us what we should do, what we shouldn't do. Good behavior, bad behavior. Good morals, bad morals, right? And the implications, the punishments, the rewards that we see in the Pentateuch in particular, right? But also and the rest of the Old Testament text. Okay, so in the beginning was the Logos. And the Logos was with God. And the Logos was God. Okay, now that would not necessarily go beyond what some people said about the Logos. Philo gets pretty close to identifying the two. And that's one thing I thought about having up here too, are some Stoic texts which clearly identify the Logos with God. So that's not necessarily earth-shattering, I would say, but it is pushing what I think probably a lot of people would say about the Logos. Not going to identify him with God. But let's be clear here. When John says God, and we can go further than that, right? When the New Testament says God, it refers to Yahweh. It's not some ambiguous term to talk about the creator and sustainer of the world, right? When people talk about God today, they don't necessarily, in our society, in Western society, they don't necessarily identify it as the God of the Old Testament. But in the New Testament, that's how we should read it. So it's not just, again, it's not just some ambiguous term for God, because now we live in a monotheistic society, but they didn't. Well, I could imagine some readers saying, what God is he talking about? But not Jewish Christians or Gentile Christians. I don't think they would have that question. They'd know which God he's talking about, right? So here we have a statement of deity. Some people have made a big deal about language here. I'm not going to make a big deal about it. I'm going to say one thing and then move on, because I don't think it's that important. Some people have looked at this and they said there's no article in front of God. Article, anybody know what an article is in terms of grammar? What is it? What? Yeah, it's like the, right? There's no the before this term. So some people say maybe we should take it adjectivally. Therefore, the Logos was divine. And that's an expression we find in writers like Philo. But it's not an adjective. And it doesn't matter that there's not an article there. This is a very common construction in Greek. There's nothing unusual about this. And there's really no better way to translate it. It's a claim about Jesus as the Logos, divinity, deity. He's God. He's identified with God, period. Again, there's really nothing else to say about it. Well, until we try to explain how they're identified, that's when things get difficult, right? Any questions about that? Oh, that's a good question. I think definitely the word logo, right, is from this word, this term, I should say term, to avoid confusion. I don't think it probably has its roots in like this passage necessarily. But I'm not entirely sure how it comes to represent certain things. Maybe that's just it. It's just representative, right? Logos term is representative of the object, like I was saying. That's probably all it is. I don't know that it necessarily goes back to this Christian conception, right? Any other questions about verse 1? Okay, well, we've got verse 2. He was in the beginning with God, which seems redundant, right? He just said it. But I think this is setting up what he mentions in verse 3. All things came into being through him. And without him, not one thing came into being. I like that translation because that's really what it says. Not one thing was created without him. Nothing. He's over everything. He created every single thing, right? And then it shifts. The language shifts. All right, so far, let's summarize. The Logos was with God in the beginning. The Logos was God. The Logos is creator. Okay? Now he shifts and he leaves this Logos terminology for a while and talks about a couple of different things. First of all, he says, what has come into being in him was life. Now, in this context, what does life probably mean? It probably means physical life. But then he says the life was the light of all people. Is this physical or is this spiritual or is it both? I think it's probably both. And that's what John does a lot, by the way. When I said this on Sunday, he's purposefully ambiguous. Ambiguity literally means one of two options. And so I think that's what I mean. Or not, I think that's what he's doing. It's one of two meanings, right? Could be either one. And he wants us to explore both possibilities. Okay, so I think that's what he says here. The life was the light of all people. And notice verse 5 carefully. Here's another grammar question. What tense is the verb shines? Anybody know? Present. Is it? Yeah, good. It's present, exactly. What about the second phrase? The darkness did not overcome it. It's past tense. This is not a translation error. That's what the Greek says. Why does he do that? Why does he have present and then he switches to past? Good question. And I'm not entirely sure. But I think what's going on here is he's saying, and remember, and this is going to come up in the next few verses. John is dealing with two things, just like the synoptic writers. They are telling the story of Jesus on the one hand. Oh, man. They're telling the story of Jesus on the one hand. But on the other hand, they're helping their communities. And so I think here we get a glimpse that this is to help people at all times. The light didn't just shine in the darkness. The light shines in the darkness. Always does. Well, what's the implication of that? Well, one implication is whatever we're going through, no matter how difficult it is, the light shines in the darkness. It doesn't stop, right? But then he says the darkness did not overcome it. Is there any event where somebody might have said, you know what, the darkness won that day? What would that be? It's crucifixion. I think that might be what he's referring to. Even when it looked like darkness had won, it didn't. Darkness did not overcome it. I think that's why you've got to switch in tense here. Okay, any questions about the first five verses? All right, well, I think we've got time to go through these verses. Okay, if we skipped these three verses, I think things would make sense. But think about what we've been reading, right? We're like on the highest mountaintop, exploring these very rich concepts, theologically and Christologically rich concepts. And then we got verse 6, there was a man from God. What? Why is he talking about John the Baptist now, right? I mean, what does this have to do with anything? I think there are two reasons for this. One is stated openly in verse 7. He was a witness to testify to the light. So his testimony is about the light. But then verse 8 gives us the other clue. He himself was not the light. I think that given the cost and given the time it would take to produce something, you don't just say stuff to be saying it, right? It's not like social media today, where a lot of people use it just, you know what, I feel like saying this, I'm going to type it or whatever, right? No, it's too expensive. I mean, yeah, there are texts where you're thinking, what is this person doing, right? But this is too expensive. It's too important. So in other words, I don't think he's just saying offhandedly, oh, he himself is not the light. No, I think there's a practical significance for this. What is it? Do you think it's possible there were some early Christians who thought, you know what, maybe I should be following John the Baptist? They're baptized by John. They hear his preaching. They hear how powerful his preaching is. And you think, you know what, I'm going to be his disciple. I'm not concerned about Jesus. Maybe they wouldn't say it that strongly, right? But they would say, no, I'm just going to kind of stick to John. There's evidence of that. I think there's evidence in the New Testament. What's interesting, though, is in the Gospel of John, the ministries of John the Baptist and Jesus overlap. And they do in the Synoptics, of course, but it's not as explicit, right? In the Synoptics, you get the impression that John kind of stops and then Jesus takes over. But in John, like I said, they overlap. So, for example, in chapter 3, 23 to 24, John was also baptizing at Enon near Salim because water was abundant there and people kept coming and were being baptized. John, of course, had not yet been thrown into prison. Jesus is already active. So they are working at the same time. We have other evidence. Acts 19. This is the evidence, even in the New Testament, that there were some people who were disciples of John and they didn't have all the information about Jesus. Did you receive the Holy Spirit when you became believers? They replied, no, we've not even heard there is a Spirit, the Holy Spirit. He said, into what were you baptized? They answered, into John's baptism. This is Paul's conversation with these disciples at Ephesus. They're baptized into John's baptism. They don't know anything about this Holy Spirit and how it's associated with Christian baptism, we might say. Baptism in the name of Jesus. They don't know anything about that, right? Well, again, what's going on here? Seems like there were people who thought John the Baptist was the real deal. And there's other evidence of this too in early Christianity. So is it possible that there were people in John's community, or maybe threatening that community, who were saying, you know what, John the Baptist is more impressive than Jesus? And John says, no, he wasn't the light. He came to testify about the light, right? I think that makes a lot of sense. Otherwise, the passage doesn't seem to fit a whole lot. All right, so we talked about the very beginning. We talked about John. Next time, we'll finish the prologue, and we'll get into the more narrative sections of the text. All right, thank you.